Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You're listening to a talk as part of the Designing Longitudinal Research in Complex Multiprofessional Environments conference, organised by the Scottish Child Care and Protection Network. This talk was recorded on the 21st of April 2011. Lisa Calderwood, MCS, Survey Design Issues and Child Outcome Measures in the Millennium Cohort Study.
Good morning, everyone. I'm very pleased to be here today. And I'm sorry I wasn't able to join you yesterday. I understand it was a really interesting and productive day. And so I'm very pleased to be here to kind of pick up and continue with your discussions from yesterday. The focus of my talk is going to be on the Millennium Cohort Study, which is one of three British birth cohort studies that we run at the Centre for Longitudinal Studies. I understand that yesterday there was particularly Paul's presentation kind of talked about the birth cohort studies that we have in the UK more generally. So, and I'm sure lots of you will be aware of that kind of tradition of birth cohort studies. And I'm also aware that the primary focus of kind of yesterday was more on kind of key design issues in longitudinal research, whereas the intention today is to move on from that to start talking about child wellbeing and outcomes interventions. So I think this presentation will be a kind of good bridge between yesterday and today, because I'll start off by talking about some of the things that you were discussing yesterday in terms of survey design, and then move on to talk a bit more about child outcome measures. So my focus will be on the Millennium Cohort, which is as one of the three studies we run. Because it's it's the study which is focusing on children and young people, which we understand is the sort of the particular interest of these seminars. So this is the outline of the talk. So first of all, I'll just introduce the study, then talk about some methodological and design issues and child outcome measures. My particular sort of background and area of expertise is more on the methodological side, so I'll probably be focusing a bit more on that and a bit less on the child outcomes. But I'll sort of do my best to answer the questions you've got on child outcomes, but I just wanted to make that clear that it's not my particular area of expertise. The MCS is a longitudinal birth cohort study tracking over 19,000 children born in the UK in 2000-2001. So far we've interviewed the families four times when the children were 9 months old, 3 years, five, seven, and we're currently planning for the next study, which is going to take place when the children are 11 in their final year of primary school. So that's going to start next year in 2012. And that's actually where I was yesterday. We had the first pilot for our age 11 survey, so we were finding out how that went in the field yesterday. The study is funded by the UK's Economic and Social Research Council and also a consortium of UK government departments. We oversample areas of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, areas of high child poverty, and in England only areas with higher minority ethnic populations. So the point to make there about Scotland and other, also Wales and Northern Ireland, we have boosted samples in those countries so we can make comparisons within Scotland as well as comparing Scotland to the rest of the UK. And we also have overrepresentation of minority ethnic populations so we can make comparisons between different ethnic groups. And it's one of four British birth cohort studies. So, again, I won't dwell too much on this because I think we know already that the UK has got, Britain has got a long tradition of doing these birth cohort studies. However, there was a big gap between the 1970 cohort and the Millennium cohort. So the Millennium cohort was the first new national birth cohort study for 30 years. We are very pleased that lots of people will have heard recently that there's going to be a new cohort in 2012. So that's fantastic news. CLS is not involved directly in that, but I think it's fantastic for fantastic for social science in general in the country that study has actually been funded. So, talking more about MCS, so the particular objectives of the Millennium Cohort study compared to sort of other cohorts were to chart the initial conditions of the social, economic and health advantages and disadvantages facing children born into the new century and to track their consequences over time. Obviously, to capture information of the future, because it's a longitudinal study, we want to capture information in the early years, which is going to be predictive later on. Comparing patterns of development with other cohort studies was also an important consideration, as was the collection of information on previously neglected topics such as childcare and father's involvement, because clearly, you know, family life has changed a lot over 30 years. So some of the things which were not covered in a lot of detail in the earlier cohorts were much more relevant for the millennium cohort. And we also wanted to capture the sort of wider ecology of the family, so locating families very much within their sort of communities, looking at the services, and also matching in geographical data as well. So, looking at how families were sort of embedded in communities. Those kind of objectives sort of translate into the study design. So the cohort was born over a 12-month period. This is kind of different to previous national birth cohort studies, because the 1946, 1958 and 1970 birth cohort study all took a complete census of births in 1 week. The millennium cohort was designed to sample children over a 12-month period, primarily so we can look at season of birth effects. So we've got a sample of children born over a 12-month period rather than a kind of census of children born in a week. It includes children in all four countries of the UK. Again, the previous national birth cohort studies had not included Northern Ireland, so they were just Great Britain. And as I said earlier, we kind of had boost samples in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. The sample was also geographically clustered by electoral ward to enable us to look more closely at the level of community level and area impacts. And we also overrepresent children in different ethnic groups and those in deprived areas. So this is how the study design principles were kind of operationalised in the sampling design. So it was a two-stage sampling design. First of all, we selected the areas in which we wanted to carry out sample the children from. And we selected a total of 398 electoral wards across the UK. And they were from three different kind of we had three different sampling strata. So all of the wards in the UK were allocated to one of these three sampling strata: ethnic, disadvantaged or disadvantaged. The ethnic strata was only in England, because at that time that reflected the sort of concentration of ethnic minority communities in the UK. The disadvantaged strata was in all four countries, and they were the most poorest 25% of areas of the country. And the advantaged strata is a bit of a misleading name, because it's not necessarily disadvantaged families, it's just non-disadvantaged and non-ethnics. Okay, so that's everybody else. All of the other areas were classified as advantaged. And then we selected 398 areas from the list of electoral wards, and we oversampled areas, ethnic wards and disadvantaged wards. So that's how we operationalised the boost sample of ethnic minorities and poor and disadvantaged families. It was area-based oversampling rather than family-based oversampling. So the second stage was the selection of families. Once we'd selected the areas, we actually took all children who were born in the window were actually eligible to take part in the study. The families were identified from child benefit records held by the Department of Work and Pensions, which at that time was a universal benefit. Very, very high coverage of the population. And we selected a total of 27,201 families, or they were identified as eligible. The process of sampling through the DWP is that you have to run an opt-out procedure, so the DWP have to write to families and say, are you happy to take for us to pass your name and address on? So they're given an opportunity to opt out at that stage. So of the original sort of 27,000 families, about 24,000 were actually issued to the field. We were actually didn't opt out, and also they were not excluded by the DWP. So we approached about 24,000 families initially. And of those, about 18,552 took part in the 9-month study. We sort of topped up the sample at age three with another 692 families. And these were people who were eligible in the sense that they were living in the target wards when the child was 9 months old, but they were just not on the child benefit register at the time. So these were sort of people who were sort of working their way through the benefit system. So we topped up the sample at age three, and then the cohort sort of total, the total number of families who are in the cohort is 19,244. And we've got some twins and triplets, so it's about 19,500 children. And the next, so this slide just shows the number of interviewed families by each of the different sweeps. So the first column is the total number of children in the cohort, showing you how that's split by different countries. And then if you look at the bottom row, that's showing how many families we've had in total at each sweep. So 18,500 at 9 months, just over 15,000 at age three, which is MCS2, about 15,000 again at age five, and we dropped off to about 14, just under 14,000 at age seven, MCS4. The next survey is at age 11, is going to be age 11, so we're projected to kind of get around 13,000 families. We're hoping to get around 13,000 families again there. And, you know, you can see how the patterns between the different countries. But I'll say a bit more about our sort of response rates in a little while. Just in terms of sponsors, so as I said, UK Economic and Social Research Council, Consortium of Government Departments, and I've just realised I should have updated that slide to the change of names, particularly the Department for Education. Department of Children, Schools and Families is no longer. It's obviously the Department for Education now. And we, as well as having funding from a Consortium of Government Departments, we were also had some additional funding from the Sure Start National Evaluation in England and also the Children's Fund National Evaluation in England. So we were part of the families in the MCS were sort of part of the control group for the evaluations of those government programmes. So the MCS study involves home visits to the families. We send professionally trained survey interviewers around to people's homes. This slide shows the kind of content of the studies and how that's changed over time. So I'll just go through each one of these sort of briefly row by row. So we interview resident fathers and mothers. In person, the interview with the mother takes about an hour, the interview with the father takes about half an hour. We don't interview fathers who are not living with the child, only fathers who are living with the cohort child. And so that we've always interviewed co-resident parents. From age three onwards, the children were sort of involved more directly themselves in the study. So we did some cognitive assessments with them and physical measurements, and that's happened at every wave of the study. So we spent about half an hour doing cognitive assessments and about 10, 15 minutes doing physical measurements. And I'll come on to say a bit more about what those are and show you some of the results a bit later on. The children have been answering some questions on their own since they were seven. So age seven was the first time we got them to do that. Gave them a booklet of questions, short, simple, and obviously in age-appropriate language. So we got a very good response rate to that as well. We were very pleased about that. And we are also doing that at age 11, although now that the children are 11, obviously the content has changed, so we're introducing some more sensitive topics like bullying, antisocial behaviour and things like that. Older siblings we've collected some data on older siblings. That links in with the evaluation of the Children's Fund, which I mentioned. At age 3 and 5, so that's self-completion questionnaires for siblings to age 10 to 15, and also some questions to parents about the child's education and behaviour. Interview observations of the home conditions at most of the sweeps, and we've also carried out a teacher survey at age 5, 7 and 11. The parent interviews cover lots of different topics. It's a multidisciplinary study aiming to cover lots of different aspects of children's lives. So, I mean, I won't go through it, but this slide just gives you a sort of sense of all the different topics covered by the study. And we also, as well as collecting data from families and teachers, we directly, we also link to administrative data. So, and I understand there was a, one of the talks yesterday was talking about administrative data. So health records, we have got permission to link to health records for the cohort member and siblings from birth to age 14. And for parents as well, sort of open-ended consent to do that. We've got permission to link to education records for the cohort member and their siblings, again, from the start of compulsory schooling to the end of compulsory schooling, so from 5 to 16. And we've also got permission to link to administrative records for parents, sorry, economic records for parents. So that's, you know, the work and pensions, longitudinal study, benefits and tax credits, that kind of thing. So we've got lots of permissions to link to administrative data linkage. We've not actually got that much linked administrative data as yet, because, you know, some of you, you know, getting the permissions is to some extent the easy part, and essentially we're trying to raise co-funding to actually do the linkage. There was some funding to there was a funded project which linked to birth records and maternity episode records at 9 months. So that data was, that linkage was done. The linked data is available from the data archive. We've also got a project which is funded at the moment, funded by the MRC, to link to health records for the cohort member up to age 14. And also we're investigating linkage to primary care data as well. So it's not just hospital episode statistics; it's potentially primary care data as well. And I think that is just for the cohort member at the moment. And in terms of education, we also do have some linked data on education. We've got I mentioned that we did a survey of teachers at age 5. That survey actually was just in Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, because in England we have this foundation stage profile where all the teachers kind of fill in the record of the children's performance at the end of the first year of compulsory schooling. So we've got that linked data in England, and we've got equivalent data for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland from a teacher survey as well. And we're also linking to the National Pupil Database in England and Wales, and we're also trying to link to the equivalent records in Scotland and Northern Ireland as well. Add-on studies. So as well as all that's the kind of core funded stuff. We've also had several add-on studies. We collected an oral fluid sample at age 3 from the children to look at exposure to infections. We collected shed milk teeth from the children age 6 onwards. We were like the tooth fairy. Please send us your teeth as they fall out. So that's funded by the Health Protection Agency to look at lead exposure. And we've also got a grant application into the Medical Research Council at the moment to collect saliva samples for DNA from natural mothers, natural fathers, and the children themselves at age 11. So we were piloting that. So I was hearing about how that had gone in the field yesterday. So it's all going quite well. We had a project funded by the Wellcome Trust on physical activity monitoring at age 7. So the children were sent an accelerometer, which they had to wear for 7 days. That data was collected. It will be sort of in the public domain, I think, next year. Sub-study of mothers who had assisted fertility treatments, and which was done jointly with the National Perinatal Epidemiology Unit in Oxford, and a nursery observation study, which was done jointly with Cathy Silver at IOE at age 3. So we actually sent in some trained observers to interview, to observe the quality of the nurseries and some of the settings that the children were in. And we've also had a methodological study funded by the ESRC, which was to look into refusal conversion. That was my introduction. So moving on to methodological design issues. So methodology. So this is the sort of theoretical framework that we use to sort of think about sort of error in our study. So you know, the intention is to sort of minimise the Bob Groves 89 work on total survey error. So the intention is to kind of minimise survey error, and these are the main sources of error. non-observational error, which is just from not having any data on somebody, coverage error, sampling error, and also non-response, which is the main source of the non-observational error, and then also measurement error. So I was going to say a bit about each of those and also talk a little bit about surveying children. I'll just say a bit more about off-response rates, first of all. So, you know, in longitudinal studies, there are three sources of non-response, so failure to locate, failure to make contact, and failure to gain cooperation, which is different to on a cross-sectional study where contact and cooperation are the main sources of non-response. And many longitudinal studies have really developed successful strategies to minimise attrition through failure to locate. So these are just sort of saying a bit more about our response rates. So our baseline response rate was 72%, so that was out of all of the eligible families identified by the DWP. So that's essentially the 27,000 families I mentioned earlier is the base for that, and the 19,000 families that we actually took part. Differed by country, lowest overall in Northern Ireland, also differed by area, as you would expect. This shows how the response rates have changed over time. So the sample numbers we've already seen, the overall study response rate is that, you know, the 72% that we had at baseline, you know, what proportion of the eligible families. So you can see that we're down to about half of the eligible families now from 72%. The sweep-specific response rate is what of the families we got into the study, so of the 19,244 families, what proportion have taken part at each time. That's that one, and again, you can sort of see how that's changed over time and how that's composed of the sort of contact and cooperation rates. And the field response rate is the proportion of the issued sample that take part. When we in a longitudinal study, we don't always issue all of the families to the field at each sweep. So that sort of reflects that, you know, that's why the response rate is looking higher. The field response rate looks higher for later sweeps. It's because we have not issued all of the families to the field. But I think the main points are that, you know, so our contract rates are quite high, and cooperation is more of a problem essentially. So yeah. Our main problem with non-response is refusals rather than non-location or non-cooperating contact. And this just shows the longitudinal patterns of participation. So we reissue families who have... Refusing one sweep is not enough to get you out of the study, basically. We go back to you the next sweep. And we have... So, you know, therefore, we have a sort of non-monotonic pattern of attrition. So it's not just a kind of straightforward drop-off, and there are people coming in and out of the study over time. So about 60% of the 19,000 families have taken part in all four sweeps. And actually, I should say the difference between the shaded areas at the bottom and the non-shaded areas are the shaded... area at the bottom refers to the 692 families that were brought in at age 3. So that's they were only because they were brought in the second sweep, they were only eligible for 3 sweeps. So 468 of them took part in all 3 sweeps. They were eligible, compared with 62% took part in all 4 sweeps. So, I mean, yeah, the main point here is we've got a fair number of people who've taken part in all of the studies, but there's lots of people coming in and out of the study over time, and that creates its own issues for analysis in terms of lots of people sort of throw them away at the analysis stage because they just select people who are sort of in a balanced panel. It also creates issues for things like weighting and things. So we've used things like multiple imputation for imputing values for where people have missed a sweep. We've used the data from the prior sweep and the following sweep to impute values in order to create weights and that kind of thing. So lots of various kind of analysis issues relating to that, and also issues in terms of survey design. You know, when you do a history, some of them might be going back 4 years or 5-6 years rather than just 2 years, and those kind of issues as well. And these are the sort of response rates to the different individual elements. So this is within productive households. So you can see that once we get in the door, they more or less do everything that we want them to do, pretty much. So we've got very high response rates to, well, the mothers are almost always interviewed. less good response rates amongst partners, but, you know, still pretty respectable, you know, with, when you look at it comparatively with other studies. Again, the children have been pretty good at taking part in the assessments, the measurements, and the self-completions. The exception was when they were age three, because when they were age three, they were perhaps just a bit small, a bit too young, some of them, to actually have done these assessments and measurements with a survey interviewer. So we've kind of got less good response rates there. And then the teacher survey, we've got about 70%. So we do a postal teacher survey, three reminders. Again, that's quite a respectable response rate for that. And then in terms of field work, okay, so as this diagram is just sort of trying to represent the data production line that we go through on each of the sweeps. So we kind of start off with the sort of scientific questions, which, and then move to the sort of the key design aspects of the study, which are fixed to a large extent in a longitudinal study, then go through instrument design, instrument realization, and there's a gap between those two because on a computer-assisted data collection, the instrument as you design it is quite different to the instrument as it is in the field because it's computerized. Then we have the data collection, data processing, and documenting the data. We have a division of responsibility between us and the fieldwork agency that we employ. So the blue boxes are the things that the scientific leadership team at CLS are primarily responsible for, and the sort of bright green ones in the sort of bottom right are the ones where the survey agency are definitely responsible for. But then there's some overlap, which is the sort of light green boxes as well. So I think the main point here is, you know, that there is this division of responsibility, and it kind of creates kind of, you just need to, different studies divide up responsibilities in different ways, and those things have implications for sort of practice. Okay, fieldwork procedures. So we go to great lengths to ensure we get informed consent from our families. We send them a letter and leaflet in advance of the interviewer's visit. We send them additional information, leaflets, and more detailed information. So we've got three kind of advanced leaflets for the parents to read in total. And we've also started giving the children information leaflets themselves. So that was introduced at age seven, and we've also doing that at age 11. At age 11, we're giving the children a letter and a leaflet as well. We get written consent from the parents, and we also get for their own participation and also the child's participation. The children are not giving their written consent at age 11, but they are going to be giving their verbal assent in a much more formalised way than they did when they were seven, because when they were seven, it was important that the interviewers got their kind of agreement and cooperation. But the procedures we're using for the age 11-year-old survey are much more sort of formalised in that way. So what do we do to maximise response? We do several things. One is that the standard way to maximise response on face-to-face surveys is for the interviewer to visit face-to-face and persuade people to take part. But in the context of a longitudinal study, because these people have taken part several times before, then they're usually quite willing to take, lots of them are usually quite willing to take part again, we've actually introduced a telephone contact. And that just shows the success rates for that. So that's going to be important for our costs, because obviously it's cheaper to make contact with people on the phone rather than in person. We've got minimum requirements for call attempts and refusal conversions. Interviewers have to visit multiple times and be very flexible. Tracking procedures. So this is to try and locate families who've moved. The interviewers make multiple attempts to contact the families, current occupiers, neighbours, stable contacts, etc. And the statistics here just show the proportion of families who were issued to the field who actually needed tracing in the field. So actually, you know, reasonably high proportions. But then we do find kind of two-thirds of them. Either the interviewers find them in the field or we find them. Which brings me on to a bit more to what we do in terms of cohort maintenance. So Again, similar to lots of longitudinal studies, we send feedback results every year. We update their contact information every year by sending them a pre-printed A4 sheet with all of their contact details, asking them to send it back to us to confirm that they're correct. We get about 70% of those back after two reminder mailings. We encourage families to tell us when they move. We do office-based tracking, and we also do tracking through admin data, so through health records. And we also do additional bespoke mailings for certain groups. This is just a bit more about the annual updating of contact information. So, yeah, well, as I said, we send a pre-printed reply slip, and they are asked to send it back, and this is kind of giving you some information about the proportion of different types of contact information we have for different families. But I think the key message here is, you know, get as much contact information as you can and keep it up to date, as up to date as you can. You know, it's better to have, the more numbers you have, the better, really. And then in terms of the office-based tracking we do, we have a team of people who work at the CLS, one for each of the three studies that we run. We do office-based tracking, so essentially we try to contact people through remote means, so phoning them, emailing them, writing to them, text messages, that kind of thing. And we also use electoral registers and phone records, and we attempt to track through admin data. But in terms of tracking, you know, we know that investment in tracking is worthwhile, in the sense that once you find people, there's lots of evidence that once you find people, they actually will take part. So it's not the fact, you know, the people that we find are just as likely to take part as people who haven't moved. And the tracking procedures that we use are successful and comparable to most other large-scale studies. So I've only got one slide on measurements, so you'd be pleased. This is really just to flag up some of the main issues to do with measurement on longitudinal studies. How you measure change over time, particularly in a kind of framework where you're using computer-assisted interviewing, using information for prior sweeps in terms of dependent interviewing, feeding forward job titles, and things from last time we do quite excessively in terms of collection of event histories. Panel conditioning, you know, whether it's a concern, are people affected by that, by actually being in the study, has actually changed their outcome trajectory. Data collection mode, choice of data collection mode, issues of measurement error, comparability between different modes, what happens if you change modes between sweeps, uses of administrative data, we've talked about the role of interviewers. You know, there's a lot of debate about interviewer continuity in longitudinal studies. Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? The evidence is kind of a bit mixed on that, and also there's a lack of experimental evidence on that, because it's non-random when the interviews change or when they don't change. But anyway, those are some references about these kind of issues. And I haven't got very much on the children either, which is... again, this is just sort of flagging up some issues in terms of survey research with children. Data collection mode... We had a sort of discussion about what mode we were going to use with our 11-year-olds, whether we were going to get them to fill in something on the internet or not. We've stuck with paper and pencil self-completion, because in the context of our study, where we're sending an interview to their home anyway, they've got lots of things to do. It makes sense, because you can just give the child a paper self-completion, send them off to their bedroom, get them to fill it in while the interviewer is interviewing the mother. So it really makes... And in terms of data quality, you know, we feel that is a good approach. The data collection instrument that we've got is not got a lot of routing in it, so you know, we feel that we're going to get good quality data through that method. But we'll see when we get the questionnaires back from our pilot study. But hopefully, we're going to stick with that. Some studies, actually, notably the Growing Up in Australia study, they have actually got two CAPI laptops, so they. Two laptops. So the interviewer is going to the home with two laptops. So they've set the child up to fill in their own questionnaire on the computer rather than on pencil, on paper and pencil, which is, you know, sort of better from a data quality perspective, because you can automate the routing and that kind of thing. But obviously, it's expensive to buy. a second laptop. So that's kind of why we're not doing it. But yeah, there's a lot of interest in web surveys. It's not appropriate in our context, but it may be as the children get older. Contacting and communicating with the children directly. We haven't yet decided whether we are going to collect the children's email addresses and phone numbers at age 11, because there are those kind of issues about, you know, child protection and, you know, what can we contact the children directly using them and all those kind of things. Also, lots of sort of ethical and legal issues relating to consent to participate. We are sort of obliged to get the parents' consent to the child's participation. So the parent is effectively a gatekeeper. But we are really trying to empower the children and make sure that they understand that it's a decision in their own right, giving them information, going through quite a formal assent process with them, those kinds of things. And the other issue in relation to children is the linkage to administrative data, because the moment we've got health data linked up to 14, and the reason it's 14 rather than 16 is because of the sort of Gillett competence issue that, you know, the children can consent to their own medical treatment at around 14 or when they're competent to do so. So we're probably going to have to re-consent the children when they get older. But then there's issues about what age are they going to be old enough to understand what it means to link to administrative records, because that's quite a complicated thing. Similarly with the DNA, actually, you know, we're collecting the DNA from the children. It was saliva for DNA at 11. We do explain to the children a bit about what that involves and what it's going to be used for. But we've also said to the parents, you know, that they can withdraw their child's sample up to 16, but after the child is 16, then it'll be the child that can withdraw their own sample. So those kind of issues about that. I'm sure we could talk about those issues all day. The other things is sort of giving children a voice in the design of the study, which we've not really done as much as we'd like to, but some studies do have a sort of child participation panel or a advisory panel of study members who are actually giving us advice directly on their experiences of being in the study. Noticeably, the Avon longitudinal study of children do that, and so do the Growing Up in Ireland study. But yeah, there's lots of sort of issues about involving children. There's obviously things like literacy as well, and there are probably other things that are on that slide. And this is just a couple of screenshots of this is the leaflet we give to the children at age 7. So yeah, it was quite, I mean, it looks like a survey leaflet, right? I mean, it's quite question and answers, that kind of thing. We've actually redesigned it a bit at age 11. It's more of a kind of mind map kind of thing, so it's less linear. So it's I've got some copies with me actually in my bag if anybody's interested in having a look at them. And this is our feedback leaflets to children. This is some data from age 5 that we sent to children when they were, I think, 8 or 9. So, you know, we're feeding them back statistical information. Okay, that's my end of my section on methodology.
This recording is copyright of IRIS 2011. It may be reused in the terms of Creative Commons licences, Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike 2.5, UK Scotland licence. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.